How's it going?
Doing good. We are finally back. It's been a while.
Yeah, we have a guest with us.
Yes.
Would you like to
introduce? Hi, everybody.
Yeah, this is Wendy.
Wendy, could you actually introduce yourself? We'd love to, have our audience learn everything about you.
Yeah.
I'd be glad to do that. My name is Wendy Van Camp. I am Poet Laureate Emerita from the city of Anaheim, California. I'm a co-chair of the poetry committee at CIFWA, which is the Science Fiction Writers Association, which is kind of the preeminent writing association for science fiction writers in the world. I am currently working with SFPA, which is the Science Fiction and Fantasy Poetry Association, in conjunction with Cal State Los Angeles, to put together our very first televised award ceremony for the Dwarf Stars Award. It's been such a delight to work with both parties, and I think it'll be a win-win for everyone. And that's the tip of the iceberg, and I don't want to bore people. I guess the more pedestrian things I do is I'm the editor of Eccentric Orbits, which is an annual anthology of science fiction poetry. I'm the inaugural editor of Anaheim Poetry Review, which is an anthology I developed for the city of Anaheim during my term, which has now been taken over by my successor, Camille Hernandez. So anyway, that's enough. We'll keep going.
That's exciting stuff. Wow. I'm going to cheer to that.
Cheers.
Cheers. Virtual cheers to you. she's coming. She's with us through Zoom today.
Yeah.
But we are definitely virtually cheering and virtually sipping plain air today.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Plain air was the one that stuck out to you at Litfest. But it's actually a really wonderful tea because it's made with bee pollen from the local farms here. We work with rescue bees, and what they do is if they find buildings and office structures that are laden with bees, instead of annihilating the bees, they take them to a wonderful little farm in Whittier, and they actually let them basically make honey in their little bee boxes. And we continue to support the efforts. It's pretty much a nonprofit. If they buy the honey, they can continue to save the bees. So cheers to that.
That's definitely a worthwhile cause. I have my impressions of it. And of course, it's a new tea to me because I met Stephanie at Litfest in Medina, which is a local poetry festival. Well, technically it's a writing festival, but let's just say the poets have descended and we've kind of taken over.
It's very poetic centric this time around, for sure.
And it's actually wonderful because not a lot of writing festivals or author festivals feature poetry as strongly as LitFest. So I and my group, the Starlit Scribes, are very happy to be a part of it. We've been featured as a panel there for 3 years now. And the Starlit Scribes is a group of speculative poets, or poets that write poetry in the themes of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And let's just say we don't always get a lot of love from literary events. We're kind of the ghetto children, so to speak. we're not taken seriously, but the people in my group are some of the top names in speculative poetry. Pedro just won a Bram Stoker Award, which is for best chapbook, poetry chapbook in the horror genre.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, Jean-Paul is the former editor of Starline, which is the flagship magazine for speculative poets. He's gone on, he's now working on Worlds of If and other projects, and I occasionally send him things to support him on, even on his non-paid stuff, because he's just a cool dude and his own poetry is fabulous. And Denise DeMars, she is a former poetry professor from Long Beach City, and she's retired now, and she just goes around doing her verse like the rest of us. and making her way through the world. And it's wonderful to have her as part of our team. But anyway, I met Stephanie at Lit Fest, and I was really intrigued by the name Plein Air because I'm an urban sketcher by hobby. Don't ask me to show you my urban
I
sketches,
was
they're not
about
that
to
great.
ask.
But I just find it very relaxing to sketch and draw. I find it works a different creative part of my brain. And I spend so much time writing and composing because I'm not only a poet, I'm a novelist. I write numerous essays for magazines all over the place. And sometimes I just need a break from writing. So I find if I pull out my sketchbook and my paints, I'm still being creative because that's what I do. I breathe creativity. That's my middle name, I guess. But it allows me to just kind of relax and do something completely different. And I really appreciate that. So I picked up the tea, and I think I sampled a different one. I'm trying to remember which one I sampled while I was there.
If you tell me a little bit of what's in it, I could probably tell you.
I believe it was a black tea, but we had a conversation about black teas, which I found fascinating because I actually just discovered Yorkshire tea, which evidently is the Lipton of the UK. But I loved it. I happened to be speaking in Scotland last year, and in the hotel I stayed, they of course give you free instant coffees and teas. And of course, being Scotland, the hot water and the selection of teas was very prominent. And it was just this little red packet. So, it wasn't even loose tea. It was just in a sachet. And I tried it and I went, oh my God, this is what tea is supposed to taste like. This is not Lipton. So I fell in love with it. And when I came home, I did a search. I couldn't find it for the longest time. Finally found it on Amazon. It was very reasonably priced, and I picked up a box of like 50, which probably would last me 3 years with the way I drink tea. Well, I have other teas too. I like to, so I like it for the rotation. And I just absolutely have been drinking it all this winter and early spring when it's a little bit cooler and I can handle hot tea better. And I absolutely loved it. But in the past, I've had trouble with black tea. It gives me like a nervous reaction. My heart rate goes too fast. So I was originally a little leery about even trying the Yorkshire black tea because I was afraid of having this allergic reaction. But Stephanie talked to me a little bit about where black teas come from, which was fascinating. And I'm kind of hoping we can share that with our podcast listeners.
So what I was trying to explain to her is the terroir definitely takes a major effect on different black teas, and most of the black teas that are out there are purchased through auction, and they change significantly through the years or through the seasons even. But there are sommeliers out there that specifically do nothing but go to auction, buy these teas, taste these teas, and they try to keep that flavor profile consistently through. So what I was telling Wendy, if I remember, it's been a while, maybe she has a sensitivity to certain types of like estates. And maybe things that are predominantly from certain different tea, like I know Assam is a big company, Malawi, basically Argentina, Kenya, all over the world. I know that there's like at this point 13 main estates that you can go through, but we actually went in and we looked up, I think it was Yorkshire, we looked up where their main estates were, and I said, well, if it doesn't give you issues, maybe it's these estates that you're not sensitive to. So a lot of people don't really realize that these little humble tea bags that we buy, there's so much like work and effort put into them. And
I certainly never thought a lot. I was so glad to run into you, Stephanie. You have so much knowledge, and about something that I enjoy, which is tea. So this w it was just a fortuitous meeting, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad to be here on your podcast because of that
Thank
too.
you. Well, I remember how funny it was because I know our my assistant Lauren was there, and I think you guys were talking about your time in Scotland.
Yes.
And I think unfortunately you were having like issues where you needed your cane that day, and you were like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I just casually tripped and fell out of a castle."
Yeah,
We're
it's
like,
true.
"Wait."
I call it taking a wee tumble down some castle steps
Oh, and we were
head
just
first
like,
onto a stone courtyard. All I thought as I flew through the air was, protect your head, protect your head, protect your head. And I did, but at the cost of my knee. But I didn't break anything. I was able to put weight on it, and I ended up not even going to the doctor. But, I use a cane anyway just for balance issues. And
absolutely.
it allowed me to get around the convention. And thankfully, the ADA statutes in Scotland are amazing. I mean, there was only one it was like a staircase with just 8 steps, which in my condition, it would have prevented me from attending the convention. But there was a
Oh,
little personal elevator right next to it
there
for
you
one person,
go.
and big enough for a single wheelchair to go up and down. And it worked the entire convention, and I was able to use that and then hobble my way to my speaking events. So, yeah, it was really quite wonderful for that group. And it was such an honor to be asked to speak in Scotland. Really, the top names in poetry were there, and for some reason, I'm included. So, I was very glad to be there and to meet the other poets. And it was just a blast, a real blast for me.
That I mean, that's just such an incredible story, and I mean that's just a telltale of your rich storytelling for sure. I know you were just casually like, "Oh, this, yeah, I fell out of a castle," and Lauren was like, "Wait a second, if anyone's gonna be dramatically walking with an entrance with such a cane presence, it's like, oh, just oh, this, it's my battle scar from
And it's not just
castle."
any castle. I don't know if you have any Outlander fans here. I was on an Outlander tour to visit the set places
Oh my
of the
goodness.
series, and this was Castle Leok in the
Oh,
series. So that's where I fell.
incredible.
Castle Leok.
That's so
In real
cool.
life, it's called Castle Dune.
Yes. That's so incredible. My God. So you've basically been everywhere this year, haven't you?
Well, not as much this year because I traveled so much last year. My poet laureate term ended last year in May, and it was just the invitations just flooded in. I don't know how but or why, but I figure as long as they're there, I'm gonna take the ball and run with it. And that's what I was doing. I attended ReaderCon in the Boston area. I went to Scotland. These were my two in-person ones, but virtually I have been speaking at events all over the country. Oh, and I do one in India too. It's a science fiction literary conference, and they invite me every year, and it's always a pleasure to read my work. I sometimes do more essays there than I do actual stories or poetry, although last year I took the plunge and read one of my science fiction short stories there, and they loved it. So
That's
it's a
great.
lot of fun. I really believe in spreading science fiction everywhere we can. It's not an American thing. It's all over the world. You'd be amazed at the quality coming out of Nigeria, of all places. I believe there must be a couple of schools, or they're including speculative poetry in their writing. And when I was a poetry judge for Balticon, which is a convention in Baltimore, Maryland, they have one of the largest speculative poetry contests anywhere, and they have cash prizes too. And almost every winner was from Nigeria, different
Wow.
provinces in Nigeria. It wasn't all one city or something.
Yeah.
But I was the judge. I know I judged blindly, and these are the people that won. And it was kind of eye-opening. I'm thinking, what are they doing there that's so wonderful
Are
to
they
promote
English
poetry
or
like this?
Was it in English or in other languages?
It was in
Maybe.
English, very good English. You would indistinguishable from what you would hear in the UK or in America. I think their poetry tends to lean a little more classical in nature, but it certainly was all speculative, all based on science concepts, and really very a depth that was I very much appreciate as a poet. So I was thrilled actually that of the turnout. So I think there might I don't know the details. I suspect that it's been incorporated somehow into their school levels because it seems to be everywhere from Nigeria. And I have heard other poets mention the quote unquote Nigerian poets before, and I had no idea what they were talking about, but now I think I suspect I know. Yeah, just seeing what's going on. But they tend to only apply for contests or journals that pay them. And if you think about it, the dollar goes a lot farther in Nigeria than it does here. A $100 prize here is probably worth a heck of a lot more in their country. So it's well worth their time to write the poetry and to apply. This is it's a significant income for them. So yeah, I'm all for it. I'm hoping to inspire people in India to send out to the American and European presses more because they have a very unique way of writing their science fiction. It's very unique to their own sensibilities and culture. But if you look at India and their space program and they're launching rockets all over, I think they just landed on the moon. They're doing some significant strides in science. And where this happens, science fiction follows. And I think it's behooven of us to expand our awareness and invite all these other cultures into the mix. And we all benefit from exposure to this, to open up our own minds and not just be in our own small mindset.
Speaking on that subject, I'm going to segue into the theme of sci-fi poetry because I know that that's something that you have such a core fire for, and you're such an advocate and you're in it. And the way I hear you talk about it, which I think is fascinating, is in my head, the first thing I thought is, why don't we have more sci-fi poetry? Because we have so much sci-fi writing. That just doesn't make sense. Like, you would assume that the transition would be natural, but I don't know. Have you noticed anything about that? That's so
Well,
fascinating to me.
let's just say it's a well-worn topic among speculative
Well,
poets.
please enlighten
When
us.
I first started writing poetry, I wrote all by myself. I didn't really have any connections anywhere. I had just happened to take a sci-fi coup poetry workshop at a local science fiction convention where I was in the art show. I used to put my handmade jewelry into the art show to sell it boutique style. Always made a good profit that way. And but after I put in my work, I had like 2 hours before the networking event, and even though I wasn't really registered at the convention, I thought I would stay, do a little networking, and then go home. But I had 2 hours to kill. And so I was sitting in the hot sun in this courtyard. And right next to me was a sign that said Sci-Fi Coup Poetry Workshop. And I had no idea what that was. I wasn't a poet at the time. I was writing novels and short stories. I wasn't even really much of an essayist, to be honest, at that point. This was quite a number of years ago. So I went in, and I went in mainly because they had cold water and it was reasonably cool inside the room. No other reason. There were a couple other people in there, like maybe 6 to 8 people. I go, oh, good. At least there's a few other people here. So I sat down, and a woman went forward to the front of the room, looked directly at me, and says, oh, thank you for coming. This is a sci-fi coup poetry workshop, and you will be my only student. And I went, well, wait a minute, who are these other people in the room? Oh, well, these are friends of mine. They're all poetry editors from national poetry journals. You don't mind if they're here, do you? And I kind of went, oh my God.
You're like, what did I
I wanted
walk
to make a beeline for that back door so fast.
into?
But then I thought to myself, this woman doesn't have any other students. She's obviously here to display her skills as a teacher. I literally had nothing else to do. I told myself, why not? It'll pass the time. So I sat there, I took her class, and in her workshop, I wrote my very first sci-fi coup, which is a science fiction themed haiku poem. And at the end of my writing period, she says, okay, I'd like you to stand up and read your poem to the class. I looked around and I'm thinking, what class? I'm the only one here. But I stood up, I read the poem, I sat down, and then she began to critique my poem and did a good job from what I can see. But as she did this, one of the editors happened to be sitting near me, and she leaned over and she whispered into my ear, I loved your poem. I'd like to publish it. I'll pay you. And that, my friends, is the day I became a poet.
Yay.
But speculative poetry is not regarded on the literary scene with any gravitas at all. We're kind of considered a sub niche that nobody serious would ever do. We're kind of laughed at. We're not accepted into many traditional poetry venues. We're considered the fun thing that isn't really very important, But the funny thing is, if you listen to like poet laureates and respectable poets out there, you will find speculative poetry scattered throughout their work. They don't call it that. They don't acknowledge that it's speculative, even though it is. And my thing is, it's time we put a name on this and stop treating the speculative community as some second-class citizen. We are poets. Our work is every bit as good as a literary poem. We do speak about issues and things about that are going on in the world, but we look at it through the eyes of a science fiction writer. We look at the future, what may be bad coming in our future. Sometimes we look at what positive may be coming from our future. We talk about different issues of the day, but we do it through a speculative lens. So we are not just, playing around talking about robots all the time. There is meaning behind our poetry and what we do. I would say most speculative poetry has more of a narrative theme to it. We like to tell stories, but through a more verse form. But there are some that just go wild and just do these things that are so, oh, I don't know. They're just so emotional and they don't make linear sense, but on the whole, they just lift you up emotionally. It's just incredible. So we definitely have some wonderful poets in our community. And my job has always been to uplift us. I just got fed up because I was just writing sci-fi coup or just little haiku poems. I would put them up on my blog. I mean, it was that humble. And then, but I would illustrate them with my Zentangle artwork. And next thing I knew, I was selling them at the San Diego Comic-Con art show where I used to just put my jewelry. But my friend said, well, Wendy, if you're publishing these illustrated poems, why aren't you selling them as art prints? And I kind of went, oh, and my friend said, just put out two or three on your table with your jewelry and see how it goes. So I did that one year and they all sold. And I went, huh, well, this is interesting. So now I don't even do the jewelry anymore. I'm getting a little older and it's harder to swing the hammer, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
The hands are a little
Sorry.
shaky. I'm pushing up those years. I won't say how many, but yeah,
You won't
it's I'm
ask.
not 30 anymore. We'll put it that way. But I can still draw. It's very easy to create art prints. So I do limited edition art prints of my work. I'm actually thinking of transferring them onto mugs and to mouse pads and things like that. But it's very easy to do these days. It's still in the works, and I have so many things that I do just setting up a shop like that is it's more time than I have right now.
Well, isn't that the curse
Eventually,
of a creative?
I will.
Yeah, but that's the curse of a creative. We have so many ideas just floating in our heads, and you're just like, do I really have to pick one? And it's like, well, yes, you have to pick one so it'll be done and people can see what's been in your head.
Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's all I can do to keep up with the San Diego Art Show because I've been an artist there for maybe 25 years now. I think
Wow.
I've only missed it once, and that was like, even during COVID, I didn't miss because they switched it virtually during those years. But when I
Okay.
became a poet laureate, my duties at the city just became so overwhelming, and I wanted to do a good job. We had very little of a poetry community at that point, and my task was to create that community, to find spaces for our poets to speak and to be heard, and to encourage people who didn't realize that they could be poets, that they were. And that's why I created the Anaheim Poetry Review, so that our local poets could be published, could be nominated for a Pushcart Prize and for a Best of the Net Award. Several of these have gone on to publish themselves, and my successor actually was one of the people I nominated for the Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net in Anaheim Poetry Review, and I'm sure that was part of the reason she made it through the selection process. Not all of it. She's a very good poet. Don't get me. I'm not taking any of her wind,
It's
but
always good to
yeah.
have a friend with a
But
helping.
she was just a young woman who was interested in poetry, who maybe wanted to be a poet laureate, but didn't really feel that she could. But I gave her some encouragement, and I mentored her. And now here she is, my successor, and doing quite well from what I understand. So yeah, that's kind of what I do. I was doing that for the speculative community before I became a poet laureate. When I was go to conventions, there would be no poetry programming at all. And I kind of went up to the men's and I go, why is that? We are a strong community of thousands of poets around the world. You support folk singers, which are singers that sing lyrics with science fiction themes to popular songs. They were fully supported everywhere I went. There are the cosplayers who do costuming and things like that. They had their own things, but the poets had nothing. And I would get, well, what is speculative poetry anyway? And that was the big thing. It's like, what is this? And so I said, you know what? You claim to be that you want to support communities in our genre, and yet you are not supporting this community, and you should be. And I was very adamant. And one by one, I went to every convention I could, and I spoke my piece. And the result was they would schedule at least one panel of poets. And because of my connections with the SFPA, which is the Science Fiction and Fantasy Poetry Association, I had access to hundreds of poets, and I became kind of the go-to person to place people on readings all over the country. And through that, we were able to bring up awareness of what speculative poetry was. And eventually it just kind of took off. I don't have to do anything now. They know what speculative poetry is,
You've
thank
put the work
goodness.
in. That's incredible.
I really did. I had a lot of success, and this is my community service there is what was probably what got me the job as poet laureate in Anaheim. And I basically have done the same thing there. And now, of course, at CIFWA, which had no poets at all because we were not welcome at CIFWA for decades, and people are still a little angry about that, and I don't blame them. But in August of, oh, I think it's been almost 2 years now, they finally opened the door to poets. There is a financial qualification to become a member of CIFWA. But by then, I've had more than enough sales to qualify without a problem. So they opened the door in August, and by September, I was a member. And I put in to, if they wanted to do a poetry committee, I just put in to be a member. And it took them maybe 6 months. So it was August the follow, no, August, March of the following year that they started the poetry committee. And within a month or two, I was named one of the co-hosts or the co-chair of the committee, along with Holly Walrath. And our first task was to develop a Nebula Award for Poetry in CIFWA. Now, the Nebula Award is a prestigious award for science fiction writers and filmmakers and whatnot. It's very recognizable. So to have a Nebula nod is quite cachet in anyone's resume. And I'm happy to say we were able to get the work done. All the writing, all the proposals, running it by committees. And as of now, we do have a Nebula for Poetry at CIFWA, and it'll come into effect next year. So any poetry you write this year is eligible to be nominated for next year. And it's still a little bumpy. They're still trying to work poetry into all their systems. In fact, we just got the readers list up just like last week. So it's just been it's a work in progress. And I think our next project at CIFWA is to possibly develop a poetry contest at CIFWA. I'm hoping for a cash prize. I can't promise, but it's up to the powers that be if they want to spend any money on it. But I will do my best to make sure that if we do get the contest up and running, that it will be beneficial to anyone who wins. They will get a reading possibly at the Nebula Conference, which is this organization's main marketing gathering of the year. It's in a different city every year. I think it'll be in Kansas City next year. So that is where we'll have our start. So there'll be a Nebula for Poetry, which is separate, voted on by the membership, but there will hopefully also be poetry contest winners. And we'll hold, which we will have a panel for there. But I think as chair of the committee, I'm probably just going to have them on our regular Zoom because we do an open mic too now. That's something I developed last year and it's going forward this year. It's just quarterly because I didn't want to overwhelm our volunteers with a monthly. It's a lot of work. And we want to keep things easy for everyone. But it seems to be catching on a little bit, slowly but surely. But anyway, I thought if we have a contest winner, we can just interview them there and have them do their reading on our own thing and pop it on the CIFWA YouTube channel so everyone can see them. My belief is if you can't give money, give a lot of publicity. And that's my that's the trade-off. And I, even though I'm a poet laureate, I still submit work to journals that don't pay. And people go, why? How isn't this beneath you? Or something. And I go, no, I like to support smaller journals. I like to support projects that I think are beneficial. Or if the editor happens to be a friend and needs something to fill an issue, and I'm happy to pitch in as long as, they work with my time. Sometimes it takes me a month or two to get something done just because I have so many things pulling on me. But I'm still happy to do that. And same thing with writing blurbs for books. I was so stunned the first time somebody asked me to write a recommendation blurb for their poetry book. I was like, I'm going, who, me? What you're asking me? But then I thought about it. And I go, well, I'm a poet laureate, so yes, that's why they're asking. It's funny. I don't really. I know I have the title and all that kind of thing, but I'm just a regular person like anybody else making my way through the world. And I really feel everyone has value in their voice. You don't have to just listen to the poet laureates or the grandmasters or whatever. Everybody has a right to speak and to be heard. And my thing is uplifting everyone's voice, not just my own. I'm happy when people listen to me or buy my book or whatever, but it's we're all in this together. There's no reason for a lot of this shenanigans that go on in the poetry community, which is unfortunate. I think we should all be out there to uplift each other and maybe leave the snobbery at the back door,
I
where it
think what
belongs.
people forget is a laureate is a poet for the people in the sense that they build that community that continues poetry. And it's a great fancy title. Don't get me wrong, Wendy. It's an incredible title, and I absolutely commend you for it. But I think what's beautiful, especially hearing you talk, is we get to hear the behind the scenes and the work that you put in with this responsible, like this title that's been bestowed on you.
A lot
And
of work.
yeah, oh, trust me, I can tell. I'm just hearing you talk, and I'm like, my goodness, this is incredible. This is a lot. But it's just great to know that even till now, I think it is an important idea. Like, it's important to know that the community of poets have someone rooting for them, and they have a figure, like a mentor, that's going to bat and putting in the work and making these programs happen.
Yep.
That being said, though, since I heard everything that you're going through, and then on top of that, you're a novelist, and you said you've done blogs in the past, and you write all over editorials. How do you process that in your mind, and how do you create schedules in the daily for your writing, and how do you choose which one to work on at that time? Is there like a strict discipline schedule that you go through, or is it a I just need to dedicate blocks of time to let my mind wander? I'm curious.
Actually, I'm kind of a helter-skelter kind of person. I'm not really, I don't really have a quote-unquote strict schedule. Now, I do have, I've instituted about 2, maybe even 3 years ago, that I have decided that I am not working in the morning anymore. When I get up, I do not turn on my computer. I do not look at emails. I do not look at a phone. I pour myself coffee. I sit back and watch the news. I would say enjoy the news, but unfortunately, it's not very enjoyable these days. And I also write my morning pages. I have a little traveler's notebook where I pull out my fountain pen because I'm a huge fountain pen user. And I write at least one page of morning pages. And this is just stream of consciousness writing about whatever happens to pop into my head. And I put it in this book, which will never see the light of day. But it's a place where I can write down things that maybe are niggling in the back of my mind. They might be ideas for future work, in which case, afterwards, I might circle it or make a notation that it's there to look at later. But most of the time, it's just, putting down my thoughts that maybe are negative, maybe they're positive, just whatever comes to my mind. And I put it in the book, I shut the book, and it's out of the way. And I've been finding this to be therapeutic, and also it seems to be igniting my other writing. It's like a warm-up session for your muscles, in a sense, for your writing muscles. And it seems to help me that way. But I basically don't do anything for at least the first hour to an hour and a half. This is my time. I might pet my cat. She likes to come and curl up with me on the couch a lot at that hour. So she gets some of her attention at that point. And my husband, of course, works at home with me. He's in his office doing his thing. He actually gets up very early and he has a similar downtime, but he does it like at 6:30 in the morning. Because he needs to be at work at a certain hour for his job, so he also takes a little bit of time for himself. But I usually sleep through that. I like to sleep a little later in the morning. I've always been that way, and I think one of the reasons I wanted to have my own business and be my own boss was so I can get my sleep in the morning. I
Here,
tend to be
here.
more creative late at night, so I sometimes am up writing after midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., sometimes if I'm really on fire.
I've done, especially when it's summer and it's lighter, longer, and you're like not used to the time frames. Those 3 a.m. sessions, they definitely come in a little more.
I also find the world is quieter. I don't know if you're, well, you're probably aware of it. When you're during the daytime, interruptions come in, there's noise outside the house. Even though I'm in the back of my home where it's very quiet, and I designed my home office that way just to have privacy and quiet where I work. But even so, there's gardeners going off, there's noise on the street, there's whatever. And I'm just finding that, and of course, phone calls, emails are coming in, that kind of thing. And I just find that for my creative work, I have trouble working through that. Now, one solution was to pick up my writing bag with my notebook and fountain pen and go to the local coffee house where I plant myself in a chair, have a lovely coffee or tea. And I just sit there and write because people don't, if you, especially if you put on headphones or something, people will not bother you there. And for a long time, I had trouble with my husband interrupting me while I'm working because, you know, we both have home offices now. Since the pandemic, he moved here and he never left, basically. The office, you know, he does good work and, you know, and he has his setup. Thankfully, we had another room. So he has a room for his office. I have a room for my office, and they're on opposite ends of the house. But even so, he likes to come in and chat with me about whatever oddball thing comes to his mind. And this kicks me out of my writing zone. And it sometimes will take me anywhere from 20 minutes to a half hour to get back in the zone to write. And I know he means well. I try to tell him, don't interrupt me, and he still does. You know, husbands,
Oh,
that's
I
what they
understand.
are. So
There is
I have
a
learned, that when it comes to my creative time, if I'm composing poetry, if I'm working on a novel chapter, I do it after he goes to bed. And I'm not interrupted by him. The outside world quiets down. And I find that I can get into that writing zone and nothing stops me. And that's why I've become a late night writer. Now, some people flip that and do it very early in the morning before maybe their children get up or whatever. But like I said, I like to sleep. So
Sleep
I
is a
like writing
wonderful
late
thing.
at night. But on the flip side, too, I take care of marketing. I do my social media posts. If I'm doing essays for people, for some reason, I don't seem to need the zone as much to write factual essays, which I do a lot of. I'm a contracted writer at Indie Author Magazine. And when I write stuff for them, you know, about whatever writing tip thing that they decided they wanted me to write about, I can do that during the day. I can stop and start with these things for some reason, where I can't really do that with poetry and with novels. I think it's just the creative writing takes you one step lower, that you need to really find this place within yourself to really get that writing done. And you have to train your muse. And mine, of course, after all these years, has been well trained. So, and when I talk about training your muse, the muse is that subconscious spot in your own mind that thinks in images and solves problems that you're not even aware of. It's almost like a separate entity from yourself. You know, when the ancient poets used to talk about the muse inspiring them, that's what they were talking about. This is a medical thing. We all have this kind of brain. As we have an ego, we have an id. This is the id, but you have to train it to work for you, and that takes a lot of time and effort. And it's something I didn't even know about until I took a advanced workshop in Kansas City and spoke to James Gunn, who's unfortunately passed away. He truly was a national treasure, to be honest. But he was a preeminent instructor in science fiction writing, and he was publishing and winning awards all the way up to the day he died. He was that prolific and really a wonderful mind. But he was an intuitive writer. And he would talk about his methods of how he would train his muse to come up with things. And I heard the other students going, "This doesn't make any sense. What the heck? This is crazy. What is he talking about? There's no method here." But to me, I'm an intuitive writer too. And I went, Oh my God, this is exactly what I should be doing. And I learned so much from that. In fact, I've written a couple of articles about it. And when I spoke in India for the first time, their science fiction literary conference was actually established by James Gunn. He was kind of like their mentor here from America, starting it. And this was, he started it like 20, 30 years ago, a long time ago. So when I spoke the first time, I thought they would appreciate hearing a firsthand account of a student with James Gunn in his own city, and they loved it. So yeah, it worked out really well. But I credit him with putting me on the path for learning how to train my muse to let it solve my writing problems for me. When I a catchy phrase comes up out of the blue and just pops into my head, that's my muse at work. It's doing the work for me when I'm doing something else. So let's say I'm working on a book and a passage is just not coming to me. I usually will walk away from it for a while and do something with my hands. I'll draw, which is a great way to still the mind and but in a different way. I used to go walking, which unfortunately now that I'm cane bound, I don't do as much of that anymore. But yeah, it's a matter of just learning to train your mind to do these kinds of things. And the older you are, the more rich and in depth it becomes. So our elders out there, you have an edge on those young'uns, believe me.
I think what a lot of people, I mean, there's so much subject matter in terms of how to train yourself to be a better writer, how to build inspiration, what is your routine. But I mean, as a writer myself, I exactly what you're talking about, training your muse, and just the only way you can train something is by doing. And there's just going to come a point where you go from laughably writing to the writing comes. And it's a shame all the issues around NaNoWriMo right now, but I feel like that was such a powerful tool because it just forced c people to write horribly until that wall was broken and you could hear your muse.
Yeah, that's actually where I trained. I did NaNoWriMo for many years, and then I became what they call an ML, which is a municipal liaison. And I kind of ran our, well, I was a co-person. I had someone helping me, but I ran the South Orange County chapter for about 7 years. But then finally, I kind of got burned out and tired and moved on. But I really just got tired is because I was going there because I wanted to write too. But I spent so much time mentoring and training other writers that I wasn't able to get my own writing done. And after a couple of years, and I was also I suffered an illness that made it very difficult for me to go out physically and be an ML. So that probably was the main reason I left. I am a survivor of Cushing's disease, and it causes a great deal of fatigue, memory loss. You gain a lot of weight. I was almost 300 pounds toward the end, and other issues that I don't really want to go into, but it affects your entire body. It
No,
is fatal unless you have a cure.
Our former puppy actually suffered from Cushing's. People don't know that animals go through it too, but
Oh yeah, they do. It's
it's horrible. Yeah, I totally know.
when a tumor takes over the function of your pituitary gland, and you can't survive even a day without it. So my body was being pumped full of maybe 15 times normal cortisol hormone 24/7, and naturally you have a very low level, and it shuts off at night. So I wasn't getting that shut off time. And basically, every organ in my body was disintegrating before my eyes. But within the last 20 years, they have developed a surgical cure, which means they go in and they remove the tumor. And when the tumor's gone, hopefully your pituitary gland wakes up. Most people have a dormant one, so they're not producing cortisol. And if they are not given artificial cortisol, they'll die. And in some cases, the gland never wakes up again. and they are on
Wow.
this medication to the end of their days, and it's not an easy time, to be
No.
honest. I, for some reason, my little pituitary gland never shut down. I don't know why, because they said they'd never seen it before. I'm the only one, evidently,
Oh.
that had this. My little pituitary kept chugging along there,
You're
and
like, not something I'm proud of, but okay.
yeah, but it's the thing is, I never had to take the medications or whatever, but I still suffered when my cortisol dropped down to normal and shut off at night as it would normally do. My body didn't know how to take it. When I was first diagnosed, I go, I don't know if I'm sick or not. I don't feel anything. And they go, no, you're like a frog in a vat of water where the
You're
temperature has
used
been
to it by
rising and you
now.
just don't realize it. But once you take the cure, you will understand. And boy, they were right. I used to be very angry a lot, and I never knew why. There would be no logical reason, but I'd be furious at people sometimes. It was because my cortisol levels were so high. And thankfully, I'm an analytic kind of person, and I was able to logically go through why I was feeling anger, so I would not lash out at people. But inside, I was, oh my goodness, I was very angry a lot. And as the years went by, this anger kept growing, and I had no idea why. It was because of Cushing's. Nowadays, I'm a very calm person. I'm very laid back. This is the personality I would have been before the disease took over. And yeah, it's been quite a difference. Unfortunately, the surgery left me with balance issues because it was essentially a base brain surgery, and they went up through my nose to reach the tumor in at the base of my brain, and I
Wow.
had to undergo two surgeries, one week after the first. And something during that time, through when they went up through my ears and my nose and behind my eyes and all that, it disrupted my balance, and it has just never returned. Sometimes things seem to even out and I feel almost normal, and then boom, it just goes out again. And I've just gotten to a point where I realize, you just need to keep the cane with you. I have a folding one, and if I feel comfortable enough that I don't need it, I fold it up and I can put it into my bag. But I keep it with me just in case things go south. And unfortunately, that happens sometimes. And I find I don't, I'm not able to walk the way I used to. One of the side effects of Cushing's is a more likely development of arthritis, and my hips are showing it. I'm not really that old to have arthritis the way I do, but it is a side effect of the illness that I had. So, it is what it is. They gave me 4 years to live when I was diagnosed back in 2017,
Oh my goodness.
and I'm still here. And I'm grateful for every moment of life I still have. Time to write my books, time to write my poetry, time to hopefully be of benefit to the poets around me in our community. And I take on with both hands and I hold on, and that's it. I'm grateful to be here. I'm glad God has given me these extra years of life that would have been taken away. So and I'm grateful too for my husband who stood by me through all this. When I had my surgeries, I was completely incapacitated. I was told I couldn't pick up more than 10 pounds because otherwise the plate in my brain might pop or something,
Wow,
which is
goodness.
very scary. I was told,
Yeah.
don't laugh, don't sneeze, don't cough.
So
You know,
basically just
how do you
be a
do
living
that, right?
doll.
So every time I had a sneezing jag, I was so afraid the plate in my brain would pop. Oh God, it was horrible.
Wow.
And I couldn't really walk anywhere. I suffered from horrible fatigue and joint pain. It was endless. I was told it'd be maybe 6 months. Turned out to be more like 2 to 3 years. And of course, I still feel the arthritis now.
Yeah.
So I basically dropped off the face of the earth in 2018. And nobody saw me for quite a while, but I told people that I was undergoing surgery and that I would disappear because of recovery time, and to not be, just so they would know and not worry that, that I'm still here. And I still managed to get out to the Anaheim open mic just because the library is very ADA compliant. They had this wide ramp and an elevator to take me to where the open mic was. And at that point, it was only bi-monthly. So every other month, I made the trek, slowly went through, and there was this one spot by the lobby where there wasn't really a handhold. It was only 10 steps, but for me, it was quite the barrier at that time. But I managed, and it was really the way I was able to continue to have some community at this time. But for the most part, I was home. It wasn't until about 2020 that I felt physically able to reemerge into the world, but we all know what happened in 2020, right? So I ended up staying in my house a little bit longer than maybe. So it turned out to be almost 5 years of just being here at home. But I've developed through Zoom a wonderful way to reach out to people. I'm very comfortable talking on Zoom. I was in 2020, I was invited to be a panelist on a podcast called the Sci-Fi Roundtable Podcast. I was a semi-regular there, and I have to say the guys, they got me through the pandemic. Just knowing that I had a community to sit and chat with on the weekend, almost every week, helped me stay grounded and looking forward. Because I was as terrified as anybody else at that time. We had no idea what this illness would do. People were dying. You didn't know why. I mean, I was like cleaning my food.
Yeah.
It was
I
crazy.
still remember the instructional videos on how to like basically absolutely sanitize takeout food, and
Yes,
looking
yes.
back at them, I'm like, wow, we were insanely paranoid back then.
But we didn't know. And I mean, I thought of my husband went, "Why are you doing all that?" And I go, "Well, if you drop dead, you could take me then." But so I did what I could to protect my family. Thankfully, my husband, within the first week, evident he had just started this new job, and literally 5 days in, somebody came down with COVID. And they just literally that day they just shut everything down, sent him home with everything. They said, take it all with you. And we set him up on our dining room table because we thought it'd be temporary, right? Well, it kept going on and on and on. So finally I said, look, I got to have my dining room table back. We need to eat. So I said, look, we have this spare room, and you have a desk in there. Why don't you just move everything there? And so he did, and that's been his permanent office ever since.
And
And
the
I
rest
always,
is history.
and I've always had my own space because I've been a working artist for almost 30 years now. So when we established our home here, when we first bought the home, I picked out a room to be my office, and it is, I have my jeweler's bench here, and I have a nice L-shaped desk to do my writing on. It's comfortable. I'm actually thinking of getting rid of the jeweler's bench, though, just because of my age and my hands not being quite as steady as they used to be. I'm thinking maybe I will sell the bench and replace it with a really sturdy work table where I could do my painting and my drawings, and set up my drawing slope over there instead of on my desk. So I'll still be creative, still be using the space creatively. It's just in a different way. Plus, if I do want to do wire wrapping, I don't really need a jeweler's bench to do that. I can just clamp on to the. So it's, I think it's time, unfortunately. And I bought the bench used from another jeweler who was retiring. So it's, I guess in a way, I'm retiring too.
There you
And it's
go.
a really sturdy table. It's kind of beat up, but I think it gives a character. And I think any young jeweler starting out would be very happy with this bench because it's rock solid. I mean, it's a good bench. It's just not pretty.
That's okay. It doesn't have to be pretty to get the work done.
Oh,
So,
not at all, not at all. And I have like a rolling work, what do they call it? A rolling work bag. And I can put all my tools in there. And I still have a couple of boxes on my usual shelving where I store tools that I'm not using at the moment. So it's not like I'm giving away all my metalsmithing tools. I think I just want to use my space a little more effectively. So yeah. And who knows, maybe I could actually put a little hot water thing on it too. It'd be nice to make my tea here in the office. So
Hey.
although I don't mind going to the kitchen to do it that much.
Sometimes you need to like stretch your legs and do it. I'm
Exactly.
terrible. Like if I'm clamping in, I literally have a percolator right next to me sometimes. I know, well, okay, so the place I'm in right now, this is my office. This is where all the tea supplies are, but I have a shed in the backyard that's like my writing work shed, and that's the guilty pleasure where I have the percolator right next to me.
Oh, you have this she shed. I
I have
love
a she shed. I'll have to send you photos.
I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it.
Yeah.
I can't share mine because it's too messy. I might
That's
like to see
okay.
my
No,
office.
I
It's a
have.
good thing I have this backdrop behind me on the Zoom because you wouldn't want to see what's behind it.
I feel you. No, I literally have like a few select photos when it's not absolutely in shambles, but yeah, I have a tea shed.
Cool. That's cool. I think every woman needs one, or a space of their own.
Yeah.
Their own thing. And I guess guys, you know, we have the man cave idea too. So men, they have their place to do their thing. And
Yeah.
I think having a personal space is important, what however we carve it out. I mean, I've had a desk next to my bed in my bedroom for God knows how long before I had my home office. The having a full room for myself was always my dream, and I'm very grateful I was able to realize that. But well, I spent a good decade working in little corners or
Yeah.
wherever until we could afford the space for me to branch out more. So if you're out there and you go, I don't have an office, I don't have a she shed, it's okay. None
Yeah.
of us started that way. If you just have a little table next to the bed, or heck, even just a tray to put on your bed and sit and
Dinner
work that
tray,
way,
yeah.
it's all good because it shouldn't be a barrier for creativity.
Yeah, and I think over time it's like I was mentioning earlier, and you were saying there's just a matter of the doing, and that muse in you will come. Don't chase it, I guess. I guess put in the work as like a calling symbol, like I'm here.
Yeah, and
You
in that
know.
regard, try not to use the AI as much too, because
Yes.
sometimes it will be a detriment to your own development as a writer. Yeah, it might seem easier, and yeah, maybe for certain mundane tasks it might even be useful, but reserve the creativity for yourself so that you grow as a writer. Because if you're allowing something else to basically be your words, you will not learn how to distinguish what is good, what is not good. You will not develop a voice of your own. And in the end, it will hurt you more than you realize. And I realize AI is probably here to stay. We're getting used to it, learning how to use it. I use it for certain mundane tasks. I don't really use it for creative tasks just because I feel it isn't beneficial. And there are some magazines that wouldn't accept your work if you used AI to write it. So be aware of that too.
Yeah.
But it is here to stay. I do like the AI in my editing programs. I use Pro Writing Aid, which does use AI, but it picks up typos in my writing, it corrects minor grammar, that kind of thing, and I am not against that at all.
Yes.
I'm against having a machine write your work and then you putting a stamp on it without any editing or anything like that. That's not good, and it's not a benefit to you either. So just putting that out there.
I'm curious now, since we're talking about AI and artificial intelligence and robots, how has that affected the sci-fi community?
They are not handling it very well right now.
Oh.
There's backlash. Like many, I think actually in the literary circles, it's not quite as stringent as it is in the sci-fi community. Many of the magazines put up no AI allowed, blah, blah, blah. I think they're frightened, kind of like the Luddites were of the printing press.
Oh, okay.
They're not used to the idea, and it boggles my mind because they're science fiction writers. I mean, these are not new concepts for science
Yeah,
fiction
that's why I
writers.
was like, I wonder if they're a little more welcoming to it because they do write about those.
No, they're not really. They view it just as literary people do, that it may take their job from them or whatever. I'm of the mind that this is a new tool that needs to be learned to use appropriately and ethically. But it is a tool. It is, as I used to explain when I did digital art, there is no make art button on my computer. Okay. Maybe I'm doing things digitally. That does not mean I'm not creating things with my mind and putting my personal stamp on it. I'm using tools that are different than traditional media. Now, by the way, I'm mainly traditional media now, but that's by my own choice. I have no problem with digital media at all. And anyone that wants to do it, you have my blessing. Go for it. We all should pick whatever media we want to. But look at photography, for an example. Nobody blinks twice if someone says, "I'm a photographer." Now they use cameras, they use software to digitally manipulate their photos and all that. But nobody goes, "Oh, it's AI." Oh, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, because we accept photography for what it is. Be it on traditional film or with a digital camera, it's still the skill of the photographer to create that photograph and to market it and to do whatever they do with it. So some sell them as prints, some do photography for portraiture, others do it as art, whatever that is. If nobody quibbles that this is done by a quote unquote machine. Well, we need to get to that point with AI for writing, for other things. It's never going to replace a true talented human writer. It doesn't have that capability. The training that's been done with these machines is on a vast number of mediocre work. So what comes out, garbage in, garbage out. What is coming out of these machines is not very good. It's not creative. And it's soulless. And I think it's a matter of the training, but it's also these are machines that don't really have human emotions. They can simulate it, but they don't feel it the way we do. And that is our advantage, and it will continue to be what it goes. Now, speaking as somebody who's been a working artist for 30 years, if I make a pair of earrings, I do it with my own two hands. I hand select the stones at dealers, from miners that come from all over the world to Tucson. And then I literally go into hotel rooms where they're just laid out on beds, and I pick the strands of stones that I want to use for my signature earrings. I bought my own tools. Everything's done by hand. When I would go to Tucson and select stones for my earrings, and these would be directly from the mines that made them, or from the cab artists that would create the beads or the cabochons or whatever. But I really believed in handpicking my own stones. I had certain qualities that I looked for my jewelry. I didn't necessarily pick stones that were quote unquote of best quality or whatever, although I feel most of the stones I bought were. But I was also looking for textures and patterns in the stone that I felt would appeal to my customers. And I was in business as a jeweler for almost 30 years. So, I mean, I basically would be doing my jewelry in the fall, especially in the upcoming Christmas season. And then I would do it in the spring with Mother's Day as kind of my end point. And then I would switch over to being a television producer and director for Mattel in the summertime. Because their production schedule was only in the summertime, and I would end up directing commercials for the Mattel toy designers. And I did that for quite a number of years. The two professions worked out really well together. And on the side, just as a hobby, I was a writer. So that was kind of where I got my start. So yes, I am a former television producer director on top of everything else. Although I don't do, I'm not really in the industry these days. One, I'm older. But two, I find that podcasting and radio are more than enough for me. And but it's good that I had that training. I have a BA in radio, television, film. And so if I want to set up a program or if somebody is doing something, I'm there for a technical assist. Production skills never change, no matter how much the technology does. You still have those same organizational skills to put together proper production. So whatever your format or whatever. But I think we were talking more about AI, right?
We were, but that's okay. That's interesting. On the subject of AI, the fact that we were talking about how they're just machines and there's no depth. They're just what I like to say, and I train my AI and at least my AI is aware of it, as I said. So you're basically like a pen sieve in the sense that you store memory and data of things that I'm currently working on, and then you just reflect it back. You're just a giant mirror, kind of just trying to mimic and comprehend what you want me to hear, which can be good sometimes. Sometimes we need to hear ourselves talk, let's be honest here. That's probably the appeal of AI. Because you get to hear yourself regaled and put in a certain tone. But I think it's important to, just acknowledge, like you said, it is a tool and it is a reflection of you. And you can't be a good writer with just AI if you're only showing a reflection of yourself back and forth rather than weeding through things and finding the muse and meeting your muse halfway, since we were talking about that.
I agree. I think it will prove to be a very useful tool. I'm sure it will replace some jobs, but it will also open new ones, just as any technology does. And we just don't know how to use it yet. We don't know where it fits in our culture. We don't know how to use it in an ethical way. These are decisions that we as a culture need to make and then implement into our laws via our Congress before it truly integrates with us. But it is changing very rapidly, maybe almost too rapidly, and we're not adjusting to it the way we had in with past technologies. So, but that's what science fiction is all about. That is our function, is to explore these ideas and put them out to the readers so that they can think about it too and make their own judgments. I'm really glad to be a science fiction writer and to have this task of viewing the future and making it understandable for today's audience. That's what Asimov did, Heinlein did, Bradbury did, all the greats from the golden age of science fiction. They were doing that for their generation, and now it's our turn to do it for ours.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us today. I've loved hearing your mind just tell us everything about you. And we have a tradition here at the Authorist Cafe. And it is, if you could be anywhere right now in the world or not in the world we know, and you could go to any cafe right now, where would you be?
I think I'd like to go to Edinburgh. I love Scotland.
Was there a
I don't know
cafe in
about a
particular?
particular cafe, but
Okay.
I didn't wasn't able to explore the city as well as I would have liked to the first time, but I think I'd love to just be in a little pub in Edinburgh somewhere with my paper notebook and my fountain pen and just composing poetry and maybe enjoying a pint. So, yeah, that would be good.
That sounds lovely.
I love that. Gosh, maybe I need a pint now. It's
Well,
been a
I
hot
should say a
minute.
cup of tea, but
It's
unfortunately,
okay.
when in Scotland, you have your pint.
We appreciate all forms, so it's fine. Well, that was exciting. Thank you so much for sharing your opinions and your stories, and I hope we can do this again sometime. But if anything, if anyone were to find you, I will definitely plug your socials. Is there any particular project you'd like to shed light on right now?
Projects. I am putting together a poetry festival in the city of Tustin with the California Poet Laureate. Hopefully it comes to fruition. We'll see.
Okay.
No, just to have people visit my website, and if they needed to pick one social media, that would probably be Instagram. Like all poets, I'm there, and I have a very strong presence there. And my link tree there will take you to my free monthly newsletter where I do a ramble, kind of like how I'm talking to you right here on this podcast.
Lovely.
But I also do an essay with a writing tip for budding writers. And I have a poem of the month. If you and I narrate it as a podcast. It's called the No Wasted Ink Ramblecast. And you can find that on Spotify. But my newsletter, which has all my listings for my appearances, podcasts I'm appearing on, and any poetry that I've published that month. You can find that on Substack, and that's nowastedink.substack.com. And if I didn't mention it, my Instagram handle is also nowastedink. So hopefully you can find me if you'd like to. And that'll be it.
Thank you. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. And then virtual cheers.
Oh,
Thank you so much for joining us.
thank you, Stephanie. It's been a real pleasure.